The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Donna Jo Napoli, Professor of Linguistics at Swarthmore College. George Lakoff got a Ph.D. in linguistics from Indiana University in 19... You can't hear me? I'll come closer. George Lakoff got a Ph.D. in linguistics from Indiana University in 1966. As a graduate student and then a graduate, he taught at Harvard, then the University of Michigan, and then the University of California at Berkeley, where he's presently professor of linguistics. He's been a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, a visiting professor at the École des Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris, a professor at the Linguistics Society of America Summer Institute at the University of New Mexico, a member of the governing board of the Cognitive Science Society, a senior fellow at the Townsend Center for the Humanities, president of the International Cognitive Linguistics Association, member of the science board of the Santa Fe Institute. He's co-director of the Neural Theory of Language Project at the International Computer Science Institute at Berkeley, senior fellow at the Rockridge Institute, and member of the advisory board of the Frameworks Institute, and maybe other things since I last checked on the Internet. This is a busy man. His list of publications is long, including the books Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things, Moral Politics, Philosophy in the Flesh, Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea, Don't Think of an Elephant, and the book we're going to hear about tonight, The Political Mind, as well as several co-authored books. Let me go back a moment to my first statement. Lakoff got his Ph.D. in linguistics in 1966. This alone is a remarkable fact. Modern linguistics, that is, the many and diverse schools of thought that were spawned as a result of or in reaction to Noam Chomsky's pioneering work that began in the mid-50s, was a tiny field at that time. Most people in those days thought the word linguist had only one meaning, polyglot. The science of language beyond the study of the written word, that is, beyond philology, was truly nascent. So Lakoff entered a new academic field, an endeavor that required intellectual boldness, and he displayed that. The first time I heard George Lakoff speak was at the winter meeting of the Linguistic Society of America in San Diego in December 1973. He stood up in the question and answer session after someone's presentation in syntax and essentially shredded the paper. After he spoke, the room was silent. That kind of shredding of papers was not George Lakoff's personal style. It was the style of the syntax component of linguistics at that time. The data have rarely been a matter of much contest in linguistics. They stare you in the face and shout. The way the field progresses is via argumentation. What arguments can you make to account for the data, and what theories do those arguments support? While linguistics is still largely an argumentation field, today people are ever more collaborative and willing to pick what they appreciate from someone's work and ignore what they don't appreciate. It's a little more mellow. So the old days have been labeled the linguistic wars, and Lakoff was one of the warriors. I did not find myself in the same army as George Lakoff, though I always found his argumentation formidable. And so it was with much respect that I watched as George Lakoff did one of the most responsible things any scholar can do. He turned his attention to using the tools of his field, linguistics, one of the cognitive sciences, to address issues of society. The acumen and tenacity of argumentation he applied to linguistics are now well applied to social issues. Unfortunately, not many linguists have done this, which is actually more than unfortunate. It's deplorable. Language is the fabric of our society. Nevertheless, most of us are woefully unequipped to address language matters. This is largely the fault of linguists. who have way too much limited ourselves to discussions among academics in ivory towers, not reaching out to the public at large. But the fact is, without a rudimentary knowledge of linguistics, we are easy pawns to skillful chess players who manipulate language to their own ends, which many politicians are. Indeed, anyone who wants to be persuasive would do well to analyze speech. The pity is not that some people have manipulated language to their own ends, but that other people have not recognized the power of language and acted appropriately. Lakoff showed us this in his book, Whose Freedom? Now he's gone further and used findings in cognitive science to present to us a new understanding of the human mind, of reason itself, of morality, and the place of emotions in all this. Basically, of what it means to be human. Lakoff has sounded the alarm bell. If we continue to act stupid, we not only allow others to frame the questions and problems, and accordingly their possible answers and solutions, but we also completely bypass the reality of our present world, and thus renege on our responsibility toward that world. It is time to take a look at the fabric of our society, the fabric of our debates, language, and at the very way we think and argue, and use the power of language and mind toward ends more consonant with a socially responsible, free society. We need empathy. We have to pay attention not just to what seems logically correct or patently untenable, but to what people care about, what makes them feel good and satisfied and understood and justly treated, what their values are. With empathy, we will be able to empower ourselves to work toward a decent future. It is with great admiration, gratitude, and love that I present to you Professor George Lakoff.
Wow. Thank you, Donna Jo. It's actually quite remarkable to know somebody in your field for 35 years. And Donna Jo has been a remarkable linguist for that long. I want to start where our country started. Our country was based on Enlightenment political principles like freedom, equality, democracy. And with that came a theory of mind coming out of Descartes. And that theory of mind has become popular. It's something that we've all grown up learning. I grew up learning it. And it was very important at the time because it defined what counted as rationality. And it said that the reason we could have a democracy was that we were all equally rational, that we didn't need to ask nobles or kings to reason for us. We could reason for ourselves. So that Enlightenment reason was absolutely crucial in the founding of this country. The theory of mind that went with it and that we've all learned goes something like this. It says that reason is conscious, that it can fit the world directly, that it's logical, so that if you know the facts, you can all reason to the right conclusion, that it's universal, we all reason the same way, that's what makes us human, that it's abstract, that it is dispassionate, that emotion gets in the way of reason, and that the reason we have reason, its purpose, is to advance our self-interests. Over the past 30 years, cognitive science and neuroscience has been studying reason in great detail, and what it has found is that every one of those things is false. And that what we have instead is not irrationality, but real rationality, the way people really think, which is very, very different from the old view, and we'll get into that in a bit. But it turns out that the difference matters for politics. And that is what this is about, what this book is about. So let me begin with what I've been calling the 18th century brain. First of all, is reason conscious? Turns out that 98% is unconscious. below the level of consciousness. It's what your brain is doing when you're not noticing, when you're busy being conscious. You might ask, is it the case that reason is abstract and disembodied? No. It turns out that you think with your brain. Surprise, surprise. And you might think that certain politicians might think with certain other parts of their anatomy. But even they think with their brains. Now, it sounds like that's a trivial observation, but it really isn't if you know something about how brains work. Because the brain is not a general reasoning device. The brain is structured to run a body. So you're thinking with an instrument set up to run your body. Moreover, it works via neurons which are connected to each other, about 100 billion of them with 100 trillion connections. That's a lot, massively parallel. And we now know how those neurons compute. They do not compute like digital computers. They have their own kind of computation. And I've been fortunate enough to work in the lab with Jerry Feldman, who was the first person to begin to figure out how neurons compute. Since then, what we've been doing is figuring out how you can actually get thought and language out of a bunch of neurons, a large bunch of neurons. Now, it turns out that you can't just think anything at all. And that's really interesting, and we'll get to that. But next, let's ask, is reason dispassionate? Is it the case that emotion just gets in the way of reason? In fact, sometimes it does. But actually, the reverse is generally true. You cannot reason, you cannot be rational without emotion. And that's not obvious until you know a few things. Antonio Damasio, one of our greatest neuroscientists, wrote a book some years back called Descartes' Error on his experience with patients who had strokes and brain injuries that left them without the capacity to feel emotion. They wiped out that part of the brain. Now, imagine that you had such a stroke or brain injury. Imagine that you could not feel any emotion and you could not tell any emotion that anyone else was feeling. Okay, think about that for a minute. You might think that you would be super rational, like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. It's the opposite. It turns out you can't function at all. And because of the... Think of it this way. If you had such a brain injury, how would you know what to want? I mean, you know, how would you know what to want at all? How could you make a decision? How would you know if you'd like it or not? Because there is no like or not like. How would you know how other people would react to you? Would they like you, hate you, be angry? You know, how would you know? The fact is, you wouldn't, and you can't make decisions very well. And people who have such brain injuries just can't function rationally in their lives at all. They make a mess of their lives for that very reason. So it's extremely important to understand that you cannot function rationally without emotion. And next, you want to ask why. What is it about the structure of the brain that requires that you have emotion in order to function rationally in your everyday lives? That has to do with what are called cultural narratives or melodramatic narratives. Things like, let's take a hero-villain narrative. Very simple. You experience these all the time. What happens there is that there are emotions that are linked to semantic concepts like hero, villain, etc., and various actions by them, and they're linked to them neurally in such a way that you have a seamless structure. So let's start with the emotional part. There are two major pathways for emotions in the brain. One of them has the neurotransmitter dopamine, the other norepinephrine. The one that has dopamine goes past that part of the brain which, when active, allows you to feel happy or satisfied or a sense of awe. The other, the negative pathway, goes past the part of the brain which, when active, has you feel fearful. anxious, angry. Now, those pathways are connected to other parts of the brain which have semantic content. And they're connected in such a way that they form integrated circuitry. So, for example, is this working? No, okay. Okay, is that better? Oh, sorry. Sorry. The integrated circuitry works like this. Imagine a hero-villain narrative. It starts with the villain doing something awful to some victim. How do you feel? Angry. Then the hero encounters the villain, and you don't know who's going to win. How do you feel? Anxious or fearful. The hero wins, you feel happy and satisfied. That is, this structure, which you experience over and over again, has a semantic part and an emotional part integrated together. Now, why does this matter in your life, and why does it matter in politics? Well, it turns out that narrative structures like that occur all over our culture. Imagine a rags-to-riches narrative. You identify with the person who's poor. When they reach difficulties, you feel bad for them. When they finally triumph, you feel good for them. Your emotions are engaged at every part. Now, put that together with campaign biographies, where you have people like Barack Obama pulling himself up by his bootstraps. You have Hillary Clinton encountering glass ceilings, and so on. In short, and you have, John McCain being a quote, hero. Now, in all of those cases, when you hear those narratives, both semantic content is triggered and emotions are triggered at once. But it's not just in campaign biographies, it's in your life. Because the way you live your life is to fit certain cultural narratives. Some you want to fit and some you want to avoid. And it's also the way you understand other people. That is why, if you can't feel any emotion, you have no idea how to live your life and how other people are living theirs. Right? It's really important to understand these are integrated. It's not like part of your brain is emotional and another part is rational. It's not true. It's more complicated and more interesting. What that means is that your reason is not fitting reality in itself, it's going through cultural narratives and understanding other people and understanding yourself. You're not just seeing the world in itself. Now, I'll come back to that in a minute with other examples, but I want to skip to the issue of whether reason is really about self-interest. And in many cases, it is. But it's also about something deeper and more important in our lives, even more important than self-interest. In 1996, a remarkable thing happened in Parma, Italy. A discovery was made that is just amazingly important. It came from the lab of Professor Rizzolatti, a neuroscience lab, where they were doing an experiment on macaque monkeys. They trained the monkey to press bars and eat bananas and grab objects and so on. And they had probes inside the monkey's brain in the premotor cortex, which choreographs complex actions, to see what neurons were firing. These probes could pick up neuron by neuron firing, connect it to a computer, and register the degree of firing of each neuron in the premotor cortex. So the monkey would press a bar, certain neurons would fire. Would start peeling a banana, certain neurons would fire. When it ate it, different neurons would fire, and so on. And they were keeping track of this, and the machine, whenever the neurons were firing, would go click, 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 so they would know it was working. The experimenter one day took a nice long Italian lunch. This is the home of prosciutto di Parma and Parmesan cheese. And came back, hadn't had dessert, saw a pile of bananas, picked one up, started peeling it, and heard click, 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 click. Wait a minute, it's connected to the monkey, not to me. That is, what happened was those neurons that fired when the monkey performed an action also fired when the monkey saw someone else performing the same action. And this was not a miracle. It had to do with connections between the premotor cortex here and the parietal cortex just behind it, which integrates vision and other perceptions. Now, these are called mirror, M-I-R-R-O-R, neurons, and they happen to be connected to those emotional pathways that we discussed before. What that means is that if you see someone else happy and joyful, you know, that is smiling and body up and so on, you know what that is like to feel that in your body, and you can feel their joy. If you see someone writhing in pain, you know what it would like to be doing that with your body, and you can feel their pain. In short, we have a physical basis for empathy. We're born with it. And the question is whether it develops or atrophies. Between birth and the age of 5, half our neural connections die off. And the question is, which half? And that is why early childhood education matters so much. Now, empathy, as we'll see, is quite important in politics, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But let's now go to other ways in which our capacity for reason does not just fit reality directly. One of these has to do with what is called framing or frames. The idea came up in the early to mid-1970s through the work of Irving Goffman, a great sociologist who taught first at Berkeley and then at Penn. He wrote a book while at Penn called, actually he wrote it on leave at Berkeley while at Penn, called Frame Analysis. And in fact, he gave me, before he left Berkeley, the a pile this high of the manuscript. What he found was that every institution he studied, and this was what he did with his life, study institutions, was structured in terms of things called frames. And frames have two parts. They have what are called frame elements. For example, imagine a hospital. Okay? You have the elements there are surgeons and doctors, nurses, patients, instruments like scalpels and defibrillators, places like operating rooms and so on. Those are the frame elements of a hospital. You all know that. If you say hospital, they come to mind. And then there are procedures that normally happen. For example, surgeons operate on patients in operating rooms with scalpels. Okay? Basic things that you know about hospitals. And how do you know what's in a frame and not? Well, as Goffman pointed out, if you break the frame, you're aware of it. So you go to visit somebody in the hospital. You come to the reception desk. There's a doctor lying on the reception desk. They hand you a scalpel, and they say, you're operating. The frame is broken. That's not how it's supposed to work. Now, unless you happen to be a famous surgeon and a doctor, et cetera. Okay. Now, the idea is that we all understand frames in this way. There's nothing special about it. It's ordinary. And Charles Fillmore, one of our greatest linguists, about a year later, observed that every word is defined with respect to such frames. Words like surgeon, for example, or operation. Now, so each of these things has to do with the fact that you think with your brain, because frames are represented neurally in your brain. There are neural circuitries that carry out computations that allow you to understand frames. And what Jerry Feldman and others have figured out over the last 20 years is exactly what kinds of neural computations would be necessary to do this. There's a marvelous book called From Molecules to Metaphors, came out 2 years ago at MIT Press, that goes through this. And it's been interesting for me to watch how you can see how it's possible for neurons in your body, when they're connected to your body, to give rise to structures like this. But you understand the world always through such structures. Now, there are other kinds of structures that are important, and among them are metaphors, ways in which you think metaphorically. I used to believe, I grew up thinking that metaphors were part of language. And what I discovered back in the late 1970s is that we actually think metaphorically. And what we found in the 80s, very surprisingly, when we started looking at different language families, is that many of the same metaphors arise in language after language after language. We called these primary metaphors. We made lists of them. We had no idea why they occurred in language after language and why it was exactly that list until 1997. In 1997, a remarkable discovery was made in our lab by a graduate student named Srini Narayanan, who figured out exactly what kinds of neural computations would be required to have metaphorical thought. He worked it out very beautifully, and when he did, I realized that it came with a theory of metaphor learning. And it explained why we have the primary metaphors we have, and explained something else. It turns out that by the time a child is 6 or 7, he or she has learned hundreds of basic metaphors. And the question is, how did this happen, and what are some examples? So take a case like this. More is up, and less is down. Prices of gas are going through the roof, right? Not physically up, but metaphorically up. Or take a warm person versus a cold person that is not necessarily physically cold, but someone who is unemotional as opposed to affectionate. Now, why should affection be metaphorical warmth? Why should you have quantity understood in terms of verticality? Well, the answer has to do with your experience in the world, all right? You pour the water in the glass, the level goes up every time, over day after day after day. You pile the books on the desk, they always go up. A baby is held by its parents affectionately. It feels physical warmth. What happens in the brain under these circumstances? Suppose you're a baby. You're watching water being poured into a glass or formula into your bottle. You see the level go up every time. Two parts of your brain are activated in different places, one for quantity, one for verticality. Now, what happens when two different parts of your brain are activated over and over and over day after day? The neurons become active. Each of them is connected to 10,000 other neurons. They start spreading along existing pathways. As they spread, as they're activated more and more, their synapses strengthen. Synapses connect them. They strengthen, and then you get further spreading. And as that happens over and over, you get further spreading, until the shortest pathway is reached. And then, as it happens over and over, you get strengthening of that pathway, and you get a circuit formed. And that circuit is the metaphor. It is physical. More is up is physical. Emotion, affection is warmth, is a physical connection in your brain. And you learn hundreds of these unconsciously by the time you're 6 or 7. And we'll go into the political ones shortly. But the point is this. If you take a look at that old theory of reason, it turns out that reason is not just conscious. It's mostly unconscious. It's not disembodied and abstract. It's physically embodied. It doesn't just fit the world as it is. It uses frames and metaphors and narratives. It's not dispassionate. It has passion built in. And it is not just about self-interest. It's just as much about empathy and caring and connecting with other people. That is what real reason is. Now, why should we care? I mean, it's kind of nice to know. But it turns out to matter for our politics and to matter very, very deeply and importantly. For example, let's take a metaphor. What was your first experience with being governed? In your family. Okay? Your parents governed your life as you were growing up. What you learned then was you had activation in your brain from your parents and from the experience of being governed. You learned a metaphor that a governing institution is a family. And then that applies to all kinds of institutions, like the church, where you have a Holy Father, for example. Or a nation, where you learn by the age of 7 that George Washington was the father of his country, and you didn't confuse him with daddy. And not just here, but you learn this in Mother Russia, Mother India, the fatherland, etc. You learn it around the world, because that's what is experienced. It's your experience in the world that leads to metaphors like this. So that turns out to be a very important metaphor, that a governing institution is a family. We'll come back to that in a minute. Now let's look at morality. How do we understand morality around the world? What is morality, after all? Morality has to do with well-being and ill-being, your well-being and the well-being of others. Now, how is well-being registered in the brain? Well-being is registered in that positive pathway for emotions. You feel satisfied. You feel a sense of well-being. Ill-being is registered in that negative emotional pathway. So there's a part of the brain that registers well-being and ill-being, and it is connected elsewhere. Okay? Put that aside for a moment. Now, what corresponds in your experience as you're growing up, as a child? What corresponds to well-being? Well, for example, you eat pure food, you feel good. You eat rotten food, you don't feel so good. Okay? You're better off if you eat pure food than rotten food. So morality is purity, and immorality is rottenness. That was a rotten thing to do. Okay? Something is rotten in the state of Denmark. Now, there are purification rituals in culture after culture after culture. That's why. Let's take another case. Every one-year-old knows that it's better off if it can stand erect than if it has to crawl on the floor. Okay? Very clear. Morality is uprightness. Immorality is being a low-down snake. Okay? Being underhanded. Let's take another case. You're better off if you have the things you need than if you don't have the things you need. So well-being is like wealth, and ill-being is lack of wealth, kind of poverty. This leads to a metaphor that occurs around the world of moral accounting. So suppose I do you a favor. I increase your well-being. You say, I owe you one. I'm in your debt. How can I repay you? It's as if I gave you money. Okay? And the debt can be paid off by doing a favor in return. Now, suppose that I harm you. I can make up for it by doing you a favor, by doing something good for you. That's called, you know, that's recompense. Or you can harm me back and balance the moral books that way, retribution. Or you can take something good away from me. That's revenge. Or you can forgive me. That is forgiving the debt. In short, you understand morality around the world in terms of the accounting metaphor, which is based on the fact that well-being, you're better off if you have the things you need. Now, that is a profound thing. We understand morality in all of these ways, and there are a couple of others that are particularly important. A child in general is better off if the child listens to his parents than if he doesn't, assuming that in most cases the parents are trying to help the child. So you get a metaphor that says morality is obedience. A child is better off if the parents are trying to nurture the child, and you get a metaphor that says morality is nurturance. Now, those two metaphors are very important in the American context because they get together with an understanding of family life. And that gives rise to two kinds of families. Strict father families, where morality is obedience, and nurturing parent families, where morality is nurturance. How does that work in detail? Well, in detail, it's very... And why do we care? Let me tell you why we care. Back in 1994, when the Republicans took over Congress, I happened to be reading the Contract with America out of civic duty. And it's important. You should know people you disagree with. And I was confused. The reason I was confused is that I could not figure out how conservatives thought. You know, I was a progressive. I had no idea how conservatives thought. So, for example, I couldn't figure out why the same people who were against abortion were for owning machine guns. Or why people who said it was fine to good for to own machine guns or other guns were against environmental regulations. Or what being against environmental regulations had to do with getting rid of taxes. Or having a flat tax. And I couldn't understand what that had to do with tort reform. You know, it was very bizarre. What do these things have to do with each other? So I, not being able to figure that out, I said, well, look, I have the opposite views on all of these. What do my views have to do with each other? And I didn't know. And that was embarrassing for someone in my field. But I did realize that this was a cognitive science problem. This was a problem in my discipline. So I started doing research. I did lots of interviews with people. I looked at lots of texts, arguments that people were made, language that people were using, and so on. Vast amounts of stuff over many months. And I got nowhere. Until I realized this metaphor that a governing institution or a nation is a family that one of my students had written about. And when I did that, I said, aha, maybe we have two different understandings of the nation because we have two different understandings of the family that we map on to nations. So I worked backwards. I started with the politics, asked myself what view of the family would give rise to that under metaphorical mappings. And metaphorical mappings are things you can write down precisely. And out popped two views of the family. Just the ones I was describing, a strict father family where morality is obedience, and a nurturing parent family where morality is nurturance. Now, how does this work? It turns out that there's lots of literature, especially on the strict father family. And the literature is probably the most famous person writing is James Dobson, head of Focus on the Family. But lots of other conservatives have written on this as well. And what they teach is the following. In a strict father family, you have to have gendered parents, mommy and daddy. Can't have gay parents. Not there. In addition, why do you need a strict father? Well, he's got to protect the family. Okay? He's also got to win competitions in the world and to support the family. And it's assumed that mommy can't do either of those. In addition, it's assumed that kids are born bad in the sense that they just do what they want to do. They don't know right from wrong, but a good strict father does. There's assumed to be an absolute right and an absolute wrong. And the strict father is assumed to have the job of training the kids to be moral beings. And there's only one way to do it, punishing them when they do wrong. And Dobson is clear. The punishment must be painful enough so that the kids will want to avoid being punished and will do right instead of wrong. Okay, that's the idea. And that the assumption is that's the only way they will grow up to be moral beings. Now, if this works, Dobson says, this is wonderful because they get internal discipline to do right and not wrong, and that discipline also carries them out into the marketplace and allows them to become prosperous in a free market. And what if somebody isn't prosperous? Well, the logic is clear. That means they can't be disciplined enough. If they're not disciplined, they can't be moral, so they deserve their poverty. It's a conservative argument. But beyond that, what does this say about social programs? It says social programs give people things they don't deserve, therefore taking away their incentive to be disciplined, which takes away their incentive to be moral, so social programs are immoral. And that is what you find in conservative thought. That is, the view of the family, the strict father family, under the metaphorical mapping, metaphors map from one frame to another, imposes on an understanding of the nation a conservative mode of thought. But it's not just about discipline and so on. It's also about authority. It says that the father is a legitimate authority, and there should be no authority above the father. That's the ultimate legitimate authority in the family. And the father is required to use force to enforce that authority. Otherwise, he's just a weak father, and he's not going to be able to maintain his authority. So what you have is a version of the father as decider. Right? And you see that in, guess where? In our government, in our foreign policy, and so on. Now, this is a mode of reasoning that comes from a strict father family to our government, and the mechanism is two metaphors which arise naturally and come together in our culture. Now, you also get a different view of the family, a nurturing parent family, and it goes like this. It says that both parents are equally responsible, that their job is to nurture their children and raise their children to be nurturers of others. Well, what does that mean? Nurturance is a couple of things. One, empathy. You have to identify with your children. There's good old empathy again. Two, responsibility for yourself and for others. You can't take care of a child if you're not taking care of yourself. But also, you have the responsibility to take care of the child, which means you have to set limits, you have to protect the child, you have to do what you can to empower the child to function in the world. That's your job. And your job is also to raise that child to care about other people, to be a nurturer of others, to be responsible for himself, to be responsible for others, right? That is the basis of a nurturing parent family. It is the opposite of an indulgent family. That is, you're raising a child to care about other people, to be responsible for themselves, to be responsible for others, the opposite of indulgence. Now, why should this matter in politics? What does it say about a government? It says about that a country has citizens who are there to take care of each other, and that the government is the instrument of doing that. And the government has certain moral missions, two of them, protection and empowerment of its citizens. But protection is not just military protection, not just police protection or fire protection. It is worker protection, consumer protection, environmental protection, safety nets, should be health care. And what is empowerment? Empowerment is not just building roads and having a satellite communication system. It's also having an educational system. It's having a banking system so you can get loans and keep your money safe. It's having an SEC for a stock market so that you can have stocks. It's having a court system, mostly for corporate law as well as criminal law. It's having an energy system. In short, no business can make a dime in this country without protection and empowerment. And what that means is that taxes are what you pay to live in this country, which has those things, instead of a country like, say, Bangladesh or Chad, which does not have those things. So you have a very, very different understanding of what government is from a progressive point of view, that is, from a nurturant point of view. If you take these families and map them onto government, that's what you see. But it's just not just government and a nation, it's governing institutions in general. Take religion. You get two different versions of God, a strict father God and a nurturant God. What is the strict father God like? The strict father God is punitive. He says, okay, here are my commandments. You follow them, you go to heaven. Not, you go to hell. Well, I'll give you a second chance. Now you follow them to go to heaven. If not, you go to hell. Okay? It's a strict father version. It's punitive. There's another version of religion, of, you know, especially Christianity, that goes like this, but it also works in Judaism as well, where you have a nurturing parent God. And that God says, your job is to make the world better. Your job is to turn the other cheek. Your job is to take care of the sick, to take care of the poor, to be good stewards of the environment. That's what you're here for. Okay? Very different view of what God is and what religion is from these two applications of the idea that a nurturant, an institution, a governing institution is a family. What about the market? You get two very different views of the market. Have you ever heard the expression, let the market decide? The market, from a conservative point of view, is the decider. That is, the market rewards discipline, fiscal discipline, and punishes the lack of it, just like the strict father does. And the market is seen as moral, inherently moral, because the idea is if everybody pursues their own interest, their own profit, the profit of all will be maximized. Therefore, it's a moral thing. And it's seen as natural. And therefore, there should be nothing higher than the market in making decisions. Just like in a strict father family, there's no authority higher. The market has the ultimate authority from this point of view. That's called the free market or the laissez-faire free market. What that means is the following. What is ruled out as being a higher authority than the market? One, regulation. So it says you should deregulate. Get rid of regulations. Two, taxes. They take away profits. You should cut taxes. Three, worker unions and, worker compensation laws and so on. They take away profits. Therefore, you should get rid of unions. Four, tort cases, which are lawsuits in which corporations are charged with hurting the population, and then there are judgments that cost them billions of dollars. Okay? Those are seen as interfering with the laissez-faire free market. Those are exactly the things that conservatives try to get rid of. How are these things seen from a progressive point of view? When you take the nurturant family and map it onto the market, it says that the market is not natural but constructed, and its job is to take care of the citizens, to do something good for citizens. So, for example, you have a prescription drug market but not a hallucinatory drug market because society has decided that one is of good and the other isn't. Or, for example, in the market, regulation is seen as protecting people. Right? It's seen as part of the definition of a market that allows it to be good for people. It's seen as protection. Or worker compensation laws or unions are seen as protection for workers. And tort cases are seen as the last kind of protection that we have against irresponsible corporations. So what you have when you see this structure is a metaphorical understanding that is unconscious and implicit, either in conservative thought or in progressive thought. It's not something that we're exactly aware of. We just know somehow that one is right and the other is wrong, and which is right or wrong depends on which way you're thinking. But there's something deeper about this, which is we all have both models of thought. For example, you can be progressive and nurturant in every part of your life, but if you can walk into an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie and understand it, you have that strict father thing in there. You don't walk out saying, what was that about? Now, a lot of people are both conservative in certain issue areas and progressive in others. You might be conservative about in the economy and progressive in foreign policy, or the reverse. You might be progressive on matters of, education, but conservative on matters of social life. And all sorts of combinations occur. And what that means is there is no left to right spectrum. The idea that there is a left and a right and is a middle isn't true, because there are all kinds of combinations. Let me give you an example. Compare Joe Lieberman and Chuck, what's his name? Hagel, Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel is against the war and very conservative. Lieberman is for the war and very liberal. They agree on almost nothing. What are they both called? Moderates. There is no single ideology of the moderate. Moderates have combinations of these two different modes of thought. But why should this occur? Why should we have all these different possible combinations? It turns out the brain gives you the answer again. When you study neural computation, you realize that there is a very, very common brain mechanism called inhibition, mutual inhibition, where one circuit, when active, inhibits another. The second, when active, inhibits the first. That is, they're mutually exclusive, and this is what happens when you have two different ways of thinking which contradict each other, both existing in the same brain. Very common, happens all the time. Think, for example, of somebody who likes to carouse on Saturday night and be very, very pious on Sunday morning. Okay? And not noticing that there's any contradiction there. Right? Your brain shifts in the right context, no problem, you don't even notice it. And that is what happens in many, many cases. For example, a lot of conservatives, people who call themselves conservatives, actually have progressive views. And that's an important thing to know. And it's systematic. Across the Midwest and the Far West, for example, there are people who call themselves conservatives and who love the land. Now, they might not talk about ecology. They might not talk about wetlands. They might say swamps. But they love the land as much as any environmentalist. They are people who are honest business people, progressive business people, who treat their employees well, who are completely honest, would never harm anybody. There are people who are progressive Christians all over the Midwest and the Far West. There are people who want to live in communities where people care about each other and help each other, as you see in all those people loading sandbags in Iowa. Right? Those folks are progressive in their communities, but see themselves as conservative on other issues. Now, that is very important. We call those biconceptuals, people who have that. And it shows up in politics in a couple of ways. Take the difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on what they mean by bipartisanship. Hillary Clinton means that in some cases you have to adopt conservative views if you're going to get what you want legislatively. That's moving to the right. She calls it moving to the center, assuming that there's a center. Obama has the opposite view. He understands that there are biconceptuals out there, that is, people who are conservatives or independents, but who already agree with him on certain issues. And in those issues, he talks to those people who agree with him without adopting conservative views. Very different approach. So, for example, he went to Rick Warren's megachurch. Rick Warren is an evangelical Christian who has views that where he loves the land and he thinks we should take care of the environment and heal the sick and take care of the poor and so on. So Obama goes there and that's what he talks about, where these folks already agree with him. And he gets a standing ovation. He doesn't challenge them on the issues where they disagree. He talks about where they already agree. And not only that, he has an organization, a campaign organization called Project Joshua, which is to recruit people in such evangelical megachurches to work for his campaign. Okay? This matters in our current politics. You have to understand what biconceptualism is and how it works. But Republicans have understood this for a long time. And back in the late 60s and early 70s, it was the case that most working people thought liberal Democrats were their heroes, and they were. Now, and then starting in the Nixon campaign, conservative operatives like Roger Ailes realized that a lot of working people were conservative in their family life and in certain social aspects of their life, perhaps even their religious life, but liberal in their working life or in their view of the environment. Okay, what he did was start to talk to them only about where they were conservative, the family values, the social issues. And that activated in their brains a conservative mode of thought. At the same time, they needed to inhibit the liberal mode of thought. So they invented the liberal elite. Right? They invented the Hollywood liberals, the limousine liberals, the liberals who are the liberal media who are sneering at the poor, at the working people and so on. The Birkenstock wearing, sushi eating, I'm sorry, I forgot my latte, etc. Now, what this did was inhibit their natural liberal mode of thought in certain areas and activate, strengthen their conservative mode of thought. And they created the conservative populists who vote Republican against their economic interests, but in favor of what they identify with in terms of their self-identification. It turns out it's important to know this. Why? Because John Edwards, for example, thinks and thought that populism was just a matter of the economy. And it's not. It's much more than that. It's a cultural issue and a matter of identification. And if you're going to try to talk to folks who are in this population, you have to understand what's going on. And you have to be able to appeal to the part that is really there, like loving the land, like the part of their religion that has to do with caring about other people, with empathy. And I suspect that that's just what is happening with Obama as he's going around from community to community. Now, there are other very important things to know about the difference between Enlightenment thought, the old rationality, and the new real reason. If you believe in the old rationality and you believe that reason can just fit the world as it is and that it's logical, then you would think that just telling people the facts will allow them to reason to the right conclusion. And this is what the Democratic Party largely does. And it loses when it does it. Why? Because they're not framing the facts morally. They're not telling people what their moral system is. Meanwhile, for the last 35 to 40 years, conservatives have been marketing their moral system. They're marketing their ideas about what is national security, what is the government, what is taxes, what is the market, what is responsibility. All of these are big ideas. They go across issues, and they've developed a language for this. They have think tanks, which they have now spent over $4 billion on supporting. They have training institutes where they train tens of thousands of conservatives to think and talk and argue in this way. And they have a booking agency that books conservative spokesmen on radio and TV all over the country every day on whatever issue has come up. And that's why they all say the same thing. They have talking points that go to all these spokespeople. The result is, when this is done day after day after day, their worldview, their way of understanding the major issues, become part of normal discourse. Their language is part of normal language. And if you are trained and believe that language is transparent, namely that reason just fits the world as it is, you will miss all this. For example, who is trained that way? The media. Every journalist in journalism school is taught their job is to be objective. Who, what, when, where. Ideas, just language, just fit the world as it is, period. They're not taught about framing of issues or narratives or metaphors that people really do think in terms of. There is no genre in the media for talking about what we're talking about here. It is simply not there. The result is they will take expressions like war on terror as being simply true, even when they're applied to the Iraq War, which had nothing to do with 9/11. The result is that people all over the country will come to think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, which he did not. They will learn something false from this view. And what happens is that framing can be used either honestly by honest people to try to be effective, or fraudulently by people who are trying to lie to get the public to believe something that isn't true. So the idea here, and why the reason I've written this book, is to try to alert people to what real reason is, to the way the mind really works, so that you can be, one, protected against all of these incursions into your brain. And remember, you can't change minds without changing brains. Every idea you have, everything you learn, involves a change in a brain. You can't just convince people of someone without changing their brain. But changing someone's mind sounds like it's sweet and rational, like the good thing to do. And changing someone's brain sounds like Dr. Frankenstein. Right? You're doing this weird operation and you see the lightning coming and the weird apparatus and you're operating on someone's brain. But no. You can change someone's brain simply by repeating language over and over and over. And the conservatives have mastered that through the study of marketing, where the marketing people have learned the psychology, and that's come in through conservatism. What cognitive science offers us is a way for the population in general, everybody, liberal or conservative, to understand how the mind and brain really works and to understand what's going on in our political life. And that is why I wrote the book. Thank you. We should have lots of time for questions, and Andy's going to pick some folks out.
Thanks. Folks, most of you know how this works. Put your hand up. We'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic so everyone can hear you. Please phrase your question as a question. Let's start right here in the corner.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm excited to ask you about this concept about affecting the way people believe. And I'm wondering if you have some examples for me of the use of the arts to motivate people or change people deeply, kind of vetoing the brain and then allowing the brain to catch up. Do you have any suggestions or comments?
First of all, images and the arts are crucial in all of these things. And there's a classic story in the field of communications. When Ronald Reagan was president, Leslie Stahl of CBS did a special on all the horrible things Reagan was doing. She spent a full hour going through all revealing that Reagan was doing one after another quite awful things. And the next morning, she got a call from Reagan's chief of staff, who said, thank you very much for this wonderful report you did on our president. And she said, what do you mean wonderful? I mean, I was criticizing him. He said, that didn't matter. If you turned off the sound, he looked great. And that's the fact. You know, now it's very important. Whenever you do a commercial or any video or anything like that, turn off the sound and see what it looks like. I've seen all sorts of progressive videos that are supposedly anti-McCain, where they show McCain and Bush looking the same, dressed the same, you know, moving the same way, and they say, oh, it's the third Bush term, etc. But if you turn off the sound and just look at the images, they both look presidential. Right? So that is true. Now, what about art education? Art education increases empathy, connection with the world, connection to other people in all kinds of dimensions. It evokes, it trains many, many parts of the brain at once empathetically. It is absolutely crucial. And it's partly because of that effect that conservatives don't want there to be art education. They've been ruling it out. And it's extremely important that progressives not just defend art education, but to get out there pushing actively for it.
Gentleman in the second row here with his hand up.
Hi there. It seemed to me like essentially what you're saying would be to be aware of the metaphorical thinking and the two views of the family in order to get people to vote your way by appealing to those issues, or should I say that...
Not necessarily your way.
Right.
I mean, the idea is, look, the book is available to conservatives.
Okay.
Oddly, in St. Louis, there was actually someone in the audience who said, look, I'm a liberal, but I work for a conservative organizations, and that's how I make my money. I frame things for them because they pay well, and liberals don't. Right. But what do you do? But the fact is that they read the books, too. They don't. In fact, they even have to read them in most cases. The idea is that progressives need to be able to catch up. To be able to be, so it's fair. It's not just trying to, it's not a matter of fooling people. When you write a book that says, here are the mechanisms, then you're not fooling people. You're doing the reverse. You're educating people. You're democratizing knowledge.
Gentleman in the blue here on my right.
Out of curiosity, what is the effect of going too far? For example, somebody like Ann Coulter in the conservative movement, is the effect to start to turn people off and get the opposite effect, or does it succeed?
It succeeds if you already have that in your brain. What it does is it ridicules liberals, which works on people who already have in the conservative populist mode, that if they already think that liberals are laughing at them, it ridicules them further. And it strongly stresses the conservative ideas. So that actually it is effective. I hate to say it, but it is. It's not effective on liberals. It doesn't convert any liberals. But it does affect people who are biconceptual, and especially people who are conservative populists.
Right here in the first row.
Hi. Using some of the fundamentals I learned from moral politics, I actually do blog specifically to help raise the liberal game, the progressive game in framing. Yet I get a lot of comments from hardcore liberals who really feel I'm a conservative in disguise because I'm using those tactics, those approaches. Whereas I get a lot of pickup in the Midwest where people are very, very attuned to this and interested and think it's breakthrough thinking and philosophy. So why do you think the liberal mind is so antithetical to this type of framing?
Thank you for this question. A lot of the book is about exactly, the answer is exactly that. And I've had the same responses. A lot of people in the Democratic Party believe in Enlightenment reason. They believe in that old view that says that reason just fits the world. If you just tell people the facts, they will logically reason to the right conclusion. And therefore, anything else, any framing, can only be spin, can only be manipulation. And the fact is that framing is normal. And the question is, or if you are a fraud, you can use it to manipulate people, and if you're honest, you can use it effectively. And the point of this book is to learn to use it effectively and to learn to recognize frauds.
Over here in the blue, on my left. Over behind you. Keep your hand up. Thanks.
Hello. Yeah. You seem to have primarily addressed the question of influencing people's thinking on public policy and their voting behavior. I organize a lay study group on psychology and social change, and we're at least as much interested in how to get people to act differently as individuals in, you know, direct social change work, unions, co-ops, community organizing, and so forth. And I'm interested in what your thoughts are on how frame theory or other psychological principles would apply to this.
Well, I think it applies in a very important way, having to do with empathy. Let me actually say something I left out of the talk because it was getting long. But if you ask what is the most central concept in Barack Obama's campaign, it's not change and it's not hope. It's empathy. Because if you ask what kind of change and what kind of hope, it's in the direction of empathy. And he says it overtly on occasion after occasion. In the Selma speech, he said, this country has an empathy deficit. We need a government that cares. We need to care about each other. In the Philadelphia speech, he says, we need a more perfect union, more freedom, more fairness, more caring, more opportunity, more caring, right in the middle of that. The next day, Anderson Cooper says, what is your view of patriotism? And he says, it begins with caring about each other. That is what leads us to the principles on which this country was founded. He was asked by Ann Curry, what is the most important thing your mother taught you? He said, empathy. Standing in someone else's shoes is the way to human kindness, and that's what leadership requires. And 2 days ago, in his Father's Day speech, he went on talking about not just fathers in the Chicago ghetto, who need to come back and be real fathers in the family. But he said what it means to be a parent, not just there, but in general. And he says it requires responsibility and empathy. And he says you have to not only have empathy for your children and others, but you have to teach your children to have it for others, because if not, you're going to have a society where people don't care about each other. Okay? Now, this is central because what you're doing on an individual level is trying to arouse empathy. Now, how do you do that with somebody who identifies as a conservative? And the answer is through biconceptualism. Chances are that conservative has got some progressive views. That is, either they care about nature or hunting or fishing, or they might want to eat the fish they catch, but which you can't do in 48 states. And so on. They might care about their communities. But what you do is you ask them, what do you care about? How do you act on it? How do you act responsibly on what you care about? And what have you achieved that way? What are you proud of? And when you get people talking about that, they may be conservative in many ways, but you activate the empathetic part of them, and you find out, in most cases, that they have actually done lots of good things for people. And it's a remarkable thing. When I teach this, I get students who say, I'm going home for Thanksgiving vacation. I'm going to encounter Aunt Sally. Yuck. You know, we always have these fights. And so I suggest this. They come back and say, hey, Aunt Sally wasn't so bad. You know, she actually did some good things in her life. Not many, but, you know, some. And we could talk about them. And this is a very important thing when you're looking at working with the grassroots person by person. You want to evoke their empathy.
Take a few more in front, and then we'll move back. Lady in the white in front.
Yeah, I was just wondering. We keep hearing about liberal college professors.
Liberal college professors.
I was wondering, do you think that there are that more professors are liberal? And if so, why? Why in that field?
Well, yes and no. I mean, most professors are biconceptual, especially in the business school, the engineering school, the law school, et cetera. They very often have conservative views in some ways and progressive views in other ways. But if you ask them how they vote, chances are in most places they will vote, Democratic and so on. Now, the question is why? Well, if you think about it, why would someone go into the field of education? Education is about nurturance. It's about empowerment of ordinary people. It's about caring about people. That's what education is about, is a nurturing profession. So it's not exactly surprising that a nurturing profession should have nurturers. And it's not exactly surprising that, you know, a lot of conservatives would rather, if you ask somebody, would you rather be CEO of a Fortune 500 company or the country's expert on Marlowe? Guess who's going to say which? Yes.
Lady in the blue there.
Yeah.
Hi. If the free market in the conservative view is considered the parental authority, then why is it that in actual practice, free marketeers are actually quite protectionist towards their own interests and the interests of their buddies?
Because the whole idea of the market has to do with market discipline. It's the idea that you're supposed to be seeking your self-interest, and that is the kind of discipline you're supposed to have, and that will maximize the interest of others. So what you're taught is, to have that kind of market discipline is what a market's about. Pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Gentleman in front.
In light of the $3 trillion missing money, how did progressives lose the words fiscal conservative?
Well, first, the word conservative does not mean conserving traditional values. I mean, the word by itself, outside of politics, might. But in politics, it has come to mean having strict father morality over all issue areas. And it is not a matter of being fiscally conservative, of watching how money is spent, because you don't care about how money is spent if you're helping corporations or if you're helping the very idea of strict father morality in foreign policy or domestic policy. The highest value in strict father morality is maintaining that system itself. Just as in a strict father family, the highest value is maintaining the authority of the father. So anything that does that, it goes along with it. And it turns out that, as Reagan saw, deficits can be used to maintain and build strict father morality in our political system throughout. And when Dick Cheney said Reagan showed deficits don't matter, what he meant by that is that having deficits can actually build up conservative ideology and its strength within our country.
Folks, we have time for a handful of questions. Well, this fellow back here on my left.
This one? I wanted to go back to what you were saying about empathy, and you were saying we need more empathy in the government for the people, but it seems like you're saying more empathy, more government, And I see like a link between that, and I see more government programs and more things telling what us what like how we should be raised or how we should be what we should be taught. I see like you're saying the conservatives are the deciders, but who's going to then decide in this very empathetic, liberal kind of government?
It doesn't necessarily mean that in any way. Take the issue of habeas corpus, where the progressive view, the view of empathy, says less government power, okay, more citizens' rights. Take the case of Terry Schiavo, where the view was less government power. In many, many cases, empathy, true empathy, means freedom from people.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.